welcome to the Great Books Podcast. Today we'll talk about The Apology by Plato. I'm your host, John J. Miller of National Review, and you're listening to a production of National Review. Our guest is Roosevelt Montas, a senior lecturer at Columbia University's Center for American Studies and director of its Freedom and Citizenship Program. His new book is Rescuing Socrates, How the Great Books Changed My Life and Why They Matter for a New Generation. He joins us by Skype as we record from Hillsdale College's campus radio station, WRFH in Michigan. Roosevelt, welcome to the Great Books Podcast.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
Why is The Apology by Plato a great book?
I think of a great book quite simply as a book with the capacity to speak to many different kinds of people in many different historical periods. That means that a great book is often an old book and has demonstrated this capacity to speak to different kinds of people in different historical periods. A great book, in other words, transcends the conditions of its own creation.
We're going to talk about all that, how this book transcends its time. Who was Socrates? Who was Plato? Whether the unexamined life is worth living? Why we're still reading about the trial and death of a Greek guy who lived a long time ago? And also Roosevelt's new book, Rescuing Socrates. Let's start with a question, though, about the apology directly. What form does this take? We think of Plato, we think of dialogues, but this is different.
This is different. Even though this is usually called a dialogue, most of the apology is a record of speeches that Socrates makes, three speeches that Socrates makes in the context of his trial. There is in the first speech a kind of episode in which he questions his accuser, and you get a kind of a little riff in what we tend to think as a familiar sort of Socratic Q&A. But for the most part, the apology consists of these monologues by Socrates addressing an Athenian jury.
And normally when we think of Plato and dialogues, they read almost like transcripts of conversations or arguments or debates, right? And this is fundamentally different.
This is fundamentally different. Although Plato's dialogues often have long stretches where Socrates is just going on and on explaining this or that, and the interlocutor gets reduced to assertions like, "I always thought so myself, Socrates," or "Certainly, Socrates." So there's always, even dialogue, long stretches of speech making by Socrates.
Now, remind us, who was Socrates? And I got to confess, my vision of this guy is partly informed by the movie Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. He's Socrates to me from 1989. You know, white-haired, balding, wearing a toga, wandering on marble columns and philosophizing. But remind us, who was Socrates? Was he a real person? Is he an invention of Plato? What do we know? And how does he find himself in this situation where he's got to give speeches?
So Socrates was certainly a real person. We have accounts of his life from various sources. The most comprehensive accounts come from Plato, who was his student. But we also have, there's a famous play by the Greek comedian Aristophanes called The Clouds, in which Socrates is the main character. Socrates also shows up in other ancient writers, including other accounts of his apology, of the trial of Socrates. So there's a pretty strong historical records of the outlines, at least, of Socrates' life. By the time that he comes before the Athenian jury to defend himself, he's 70 years old. So he's lived a long life. Now, 70 is a very unusual old age to reach in antiquity. In fact, even, you know, just until recently, that was just very uncommon for someone to reach that age. Socrates lived in Athens. Obviously, he was an Athenian citizen. His occupation for years and years was to go around the city, the streets of Athens, the marketplace, the gymnasium, and engage people in conversations about kind of the fundamental ethical issues. What is the good? What is justice? What is piety? What is beauty? And Socrates became a kind of a public nuisance to the authorities because he loved to corner prominent people with reputations for wisdom or prestige, and engage in what we have come to call Socratic questioning, in which Socrates would ask them questions, and then building on the answer on the answers that they gave would often show them to be either ignorant of what they were saying or to be holding contradictory positions. So this became quite annoying, and eventually it is that practice that brings him before a jury to face a trial for his life.
He sounds like a nuisance. You say he's annoying. Why is that criminal?
You know, you might think of another similar figure who went around asking questions and teaching with no behavior or actions or incitement to anything criminal, who came to be thought of as a threat to the political authorities. And I'm talking about Jesus here, right? So Jesus of Nazareth is in Palestine in a moment where there's a lot of kind of fervor for Jewish nationalism and independence under Roman rule. And even though Jesus himself doesn't seem to have had any interest in leading an independence movement against the Roman Empire, he comes to be seen as a political threat. Same thing happens to Socrates. He's asking the kinds of questions that delegitimize the political power structure and the social hierarchy of Athens. So even though he is not engaged in any criminal activity or even inciting to criminal activity, and in fact doesn't seem to care much about politics or upsetting the system as such, he is asking a kind of question and engaging in a kind of practice that ends up delegitimizing the authority of respected figures. So he comes to be seen as a political threat.
He's charged with impiety and corruption of the young. Are these made-up charges, or was there something to them?
There's certainly something to them. One set of charges that under the word that you use, impiety, has to do with religious issues. So we don't have a record of the actual writ of indictment, but just what Socrates says in the dialogue and his interlocutor, his accuser, Meletus, says in the dialogue. But he is accused of not believing in the city's gods. He is accused of introducing new gods. And he is accused of corrupting the young. The kinds of questions Socrates asked about the nature of divinity, the nature of right, the nature of good, could very well lead someone to think that he is questioning the existence of gods. He certainly questions the stories about gods that the Greeks took to be, that were the tradition and the Greeks took to be, in some sense, true stories about the gods. In Homer, in Hesiod, in the myths, Socrates questioned the veracity, the reliability of those tales. And he had a strong youth following. Plato is one of these youth who follow him around, who love to see him take down these authority figures, and who kind of idolize and worship him. Now, whether that is corrupting or not, it depends on what you mean, depends on one's point of view. But certainly, Socrates was having an influence on young people and was bringing about a questioning of traditional religious practices that certainly can justify the charges that brought him before the jury.
And so in this work, we have his response to these charges. We call it the apology. And when I hear the word apology, I think this is a statement of regret. You know, someone apologizes for something. That's not what's going on here, is it? The apology means something else.
Exactly. It's not what's going on here at all. You know, English, the English language is kind of cannibalistic. We borrow words from other languages and just kind of maybe modify their pronunciation slightly and just take them in. One of the great sources of vocabulary for English, as we all know, is Greek. So there are lots of words like democracy, philosophy, aristocracy, that we have simply borrowed, transferred, calked is the linguistic term, from Greek. Apology is one of those words, but many times in the transfer of the words, not only does the pronunciation change, but something of the meaning changes. So the word apologia in Greek means a defense. So when Socrates delivers his apology, what he is delivering is his defense. We have taken that word in English and modified its meaning to mean an expression of regret or some kind of recognition of wrong. But that's not what's going on here. And even in English, sometimes we talk about apologetics, where, like, you know, a Christian apologetic is somebody who defends the Christian faith. So we do still have some shades of that meaning of apology as simply a defense rather than an expression of regret.
So this is his defense speech, three speeches, really. What does he say, essentially? He's accused of impiety or introducing new gods. He's accused of corrupting the young. What does Socrates have to say in his defense?
They're really great speeches. And one of the things that I love about this book is just how accessible it is. I first read this when I was in high school on my own with still kind of faltering English. I hadn't quite gotten full proficiency in English, and I could still read it and make some sense of it. They are very accessible speeches. So one of the things that Socrates says at the beginning is, look, I'm going to talk to you in a plain style. I'm going to talk to you in the same way that I talk to people in the street, in the marketplace. I'm not going to use any fancy rhetoric, any figures of speech. I don't know how to do that. I'm just going to talk to you the way that I talk to people. So it is a kind of very straightforward speech. Socrates defends himself, and again, I encourage people to read it, because when you read his defense speech, many people come away with the idea that Socrates is not really defending himself. That is, that Socrates is not making a good case for himself. It's almost as if he is goading the jury to find him guilty. So he says things like, I am a gift to the city, and if you harm me, you will be doing wrong to the god, and you will not easily find someone like me, because the god has placed me here in the city as a, he uses the word, godfly. He says the city is like a great and noble horse who is slothful, sleepy, and needs to be roused by a kind of irritating insect. And that's me. The god has given me as a gift to you. So he says a bunch of things in that defense. I remember first time I read it thinking, like, wait a minute, Socrates, don't you know that this line of argument is not going to help you before a jury? But it is ultimately what he defends in the apology is the philosophic life. What he defends is this approach to the investigation of truth and of moral truths based on conversation and dialogue, and the uncompromising commitment to follow where the inquiry leads. That is to place conventions, conventional authority, traditional ethics, political authority, legal authority, to place all of those things subservient, subordinate to this absolutely determined quest for truth. And that approach, that attitude towards living, is what Socrates ultimately defends in the apology.
He says, the unexamined life is not worth living. And I don't know if that's the most famous thing he ever said or that Plato ever wrote, but boy, it's up there. That this is a famous line. The unexamined life is not worth living. What does that mean?
You know, it seems a little bit paradoxical. What does it mean that one should examine one's life? Isn't my life, my mind, perfectly obvious to me? Isn't it perfectly transparent? What is there to examine? But in that injunction, it carries both a moral implicit message, the unexamined life is not worth living. That means that there is something about, there is a way of living life that makes it more valuable, that makes it more ethically significant. And then there is the implication that the life is an appropriate object of examination. That it's not straightforward, it's not obvious, it's not clear cut. If you think you have perfect knowledge of yourself and perfect understanding of your life, you're likely to be deluded. So there is a kind of moral imperative to a life of self-examination, which is also a moral imperative to a kind of cognitive humility. If you're always examining your life, that is going to restrict or qualify your level of certainty, your level of self-assurance. You know, sometimes we praise people who have strong beliefs. We praise people who really know who they are. We praise people for the strength of their conviction. And I think Socrates is very dubious about that kind of posture. He wants us to remain open and questioning and examining our lives as a kind of mystery that unfolds in front of us. And this kind of life, he says, is the highest form of life, is the life that is most worth living for each of us.
And this is advice for everybody, isn't it? Sometimes Plato and Socrates and that whole gang of philosophers, they get this reputation that this is for philosophy professors, it's for philosophy students. But he's also talking to plumbers and nurses and third grade school teachers and so on, isn't he?
Absolutely. In fact, one of the things that got him in trouble is so he tells this story in the first speech. He says, look, what got me started on this is that somebody went to the Oracle at Delphi. Now, the Oracle at Delphi is this kind of prophetic place in Greece where kind of the highest authority in wisdom and prophecy, the god Apollo shrine, that's it. That's, you know, if you had a big ethical dilemma or a big national question, you would go and ask the Oracle, and the Oracle would give you the answer. So some guy goes and asks the Oracle whether there is anybody who is wiser than Socrates. And the Oracle says, nope, there is nobody that's wiser than Socrates. When this gets back to Socrates, Socrates says, wait a minute, this must be wrong. I know that I am not a wise person. What could this Oracle possibly be meaning in claiming that there is no one wiser than me? So he goes around, he says, asking the people that he thinks are wise, the people who say that they're wise, the people who have a reputation for wisdom, he goes and begins to examine them and ask them questions. And then he realizes that the people who have the highest reputation for wisdom actually have the least wisdom. And part of their problem is that they think they know. And Socrates realizes that what the Oracle must mean is that Socrates is the only one who realizes that he doesn't really know anything. But in this investigation that Socrates undertakes, he first goes to the people with a reputation for wisdom, then he goes to the politicians, then he goes to the poets, then he goes to kind of ordinary craftspeople. And he says that he actually found that the more reputation you had for wisdom, the less of it you actually had. So it seems that wisdom in Athens was distributed in inverse proportion to the reputation for wisdom. So Socrates insists that this is not something for the elite, but something for everyday people, including the term philosopher. And I know I'm going on and on, but if I can add this term philosopher, which for us has come to mean, you know, some kind of professorial, head in the clouds, super intellectual, impractical person. Philosopher is one of these words, as I said before, that we just borrowed from the Greek, and it simply means a lover of wisdom. Somebody who loves wisdom is a philosopher. There's nothing about schooling. There's nothing about a lot of reading. There's nothing about profound thoughts. It's simply loving wisdom. And Socrates says, there's a line in the defense where he says, the God ordered me, as I thought and believed, to live the life of a philosopher, to examine myself and others. And I love that definition. A philosopher is somebody who is committed to a life of examining him or herself and others. And that is the life most worth living, Socrates thinks, for everybody, a life of self-examination in relationship to others.
Your new book is called Rescuing Socrates, How the Great Books Changed My Life and Why They Matter for a New Generation. And a moment ago, you mentioned your discovery of Plato and Socrates, but the story is actually better than what you shared with us. How did you literally discover and rescue Socrates?
You know, I came from the Dominican Republic to the United States at age 12, not speaking English, with very limited resources, kind of family resources. I came with my older brother and joined our mother, who was here in New York City, working in a minimum wage job in a factory, a job which she lost not long after we arrived. After a couple of years here. By the time I was a sophomore in high school, I had come into the seventh grade. So about 4 years after we had arrived, we had finally managed to gather enough to rent our own apartment, which we did in Queens. And the people who lived next door on a winter night threw out a bunch of books. It was an elderly American couple. I to this day regret that I never really got to know them. For one thing, we couldn't speak, right? We didn't really speak enough English to have a relationship. But they threw out this bunch of books, and I went over on the curb on the sidewalk. There was this pile of books with other garbage, and some of the books were really beautiful. Just like leather bound, hard covers. There were a bunch with gilded edges on the page, and I now realize that those were volumes in what is called the Harvard Universal Classics, this edition of classics that Harvard published. So there were a bunch of them there. I picked out two of those books. I didn't have bookshelves at home. I couldn't really read much English, but they were so beautiful. I took two, and I took two whose names I recognize and on the spine. One of them was Plato. The other one was Shakespeare. I didn't get to read the Shakespeare anytime near when I picked it up. My English was nowhere near enough, but the Plato was a little more accessible, and that's and what it contained was this dialogue, the Apology, as well as two other dialogues that follow in time in sequence right after the Apology. That is the Credo, which is a dialogue that takes place when Socrates is awaiting execution while he is in prison, and then the Phaedo, which is a dialogue that takes place on the last day of Socrates' life, right before he drinks the poison. So I went and I rescued this book, that book turned out to be profoundly meaningful in my intellectual development, in my life, this title, Rescuing Socrates, in a way pays tribute to that tremendous stroke of fortune that I had.
So you rescued Socrates from the trash, but did Socrates rescue you?
In some real way, he did. That is, in some real way, Socrates opened up Plato. Obviously, Socrates is the character, the writer is Plato, opened up a way of understanding myself, of understanding the world, of asking questions of myself and asking questions about the world that turned out to be decisive in the shape of my life. It kind of reoriented my mind, my vision, my heart towards learning, towards knowledge. It also kind of opened up a set of relationships that were very important. There was a high school teacher who saw me reading this book in the hallway, approached me, began to engage me, and he became my most important mentor through high school and beyond. He's today a very, very dear friend and mentor. He continues to be. So in some real way, this book did have a kind of life-saving influence on me. Obviously, the way I frame it is it opened a door, right? Because there were many other influences, there were many other opportunities, there were many other paths that were indicated by this experience that I then followed.
So your rescue of Socrates, that was literal in one sense. You grabbed the book from the trash heap, but you also mean this title figuratively, Rescuing Socrates. And the subtitle of the book is How the Great Books Changed My Life and Why They Matter for a New Generation. How do we need to rescue Socrates, or why do we need to rescue Socrates for kids today?
That figurative meaning of that title speaks to the argument that this book makes, that these old books, sometimes called great books, sometimes canonical books, sometimes the classics, sometimes just important books, that these books, in fact, matter and are vital to the project of democracy and social justice to which we as a nation, as a society, are committed. This book makes an argument for recuperating a tradition of learning based on the study of great books that has been in decline and that has been largely abandoned in undergraduate education in the United States. So it is an attempt to revitalize and reinvigorate an approach to undergraduate education based on the study of figures like Socrates, Plato, and other classics.
If our listeners want to do their own rescue operation of Socrates, maybe try out Plato and the Apology and some of these other dialogues, is there a translation or an edition of Plato that you recommend?
Yeah, and I should do a little bit of a disclaimer here. I am not a Plato scholar. I don't read this text in the original Greek. My field of academic specialization is American intellectual history pre-Civil War. So with that disclaimer, I will say that one, the translation that I use, which is not the translation that I bumped into as a sophomore in high school, that was a kind of much older translation. There's a more modern translation that I use when I teach this text. It's by G.M.A. Grube, with a revision by John Cooper. And it's a really elegant little edition by Hackett. Hackett, it's a publishing house that often publishes political and philosophical classics. So it's a very elegant little book with the title The Trial and Death of Socrates. And that little book brings together the Apology, the Credo, which I mentioned before. It has one other dialogue called the Euthyphro, which takes place while Socrates responds to the indictment that he has received. He's in the court responding to the indictment. And then it also includes parts of the Phaedo, parts of that dialogue that takes place on the last day of Socrates' life. Again, let me say that part of what makes this translation, but this work in general, so effective for the education of not a philosophy major, not a scholar, just a regular person, is how accessible this material is and how compelling this story is.
I don't think I need to give a spoiler alert here to say there's a death in the end. Socrates is convicted. He gets a death sentence. He goes off and drinks his hemlock. How does the Apology end? What are we to make of the fact that his defense failed, at least then and there?
It's a remarkable thing that even though he is... His apology is an abject failure. That is, he makes this speech, and so this is how it goes, right? He makes a speech defending himself against the charges by Meletus and Anytus. The jury goes back, deliberates, comes back and says, you're guilty. So that speech fails, his first defense speech. Now, in Athenian jurisprudence, the way that a trial worked is that if a defendant was found guilty, then the accuser proposed what the penalty should be, and then the defendant, who has been found guilty, did a counter-proposal, and then the jury decided which of the two proposed punishments should be applied. So this practice kind of meant that the accuser wouldn't want to ask for something too harsh, and the guilty person would not want to ask for something too lenient. So it kind of imposed a kind of moderation. Well, in the trial, the accusers go all the way. They ask for death. Socrates' counter-proposal at first is that he be given free meals at the city's expense. But then he suggests that he's willing to pay a fine that his friends Plato and other rich friends are said they would pay because Socrates himself has no money. But that speech in which he makes his counter-proposal, then the jury goes back to deliberate whether to accept Socrates' counter-proposal of a fine or the accuser's proposal of death. And they come back and they say, death. By a wider margin, tells us an ancient biographer, Diogenes Laertius, that second vote imposing the death penalty was by a larger margin than the original vote that found him guilty. In other words, his second speech is even a bigger failure than the first speech. Not only that, when Socrates is in jail, he spends about a month in jail before his execution. There are kind of internal reasons why the execution is delayed. But the longer he stays in jail, the more kind of embarrassed people are becoming. He's an old man. Sure, he's annoying. But we're going to kill this person because he goes around asking annoying questions. There is a sense that kind of things are out of control. And his friend Credo comes and says, Socrates, I've got a escape plan. I've got a ship ready to take you away. I have bribed the guards. The authorities are giving me to understand that they will really not, they will look the other way if we just took you away into exile. And Socrates says, no, I am not escaping. I am not going into exile. To leave, to flee now would be to betray everything I have argued for and everything I stand for. I will accept this sentence and drink the hemlock. So Socrates kind of insists, first of all, he refuses to be rescued, and he insists on accepting the death penalty. So, whoa, what a kind of insistently failing defense he makes of himself. Yet, there is a deeper level in which what Socrates does transforms the world. If Socrates had fled, we probably would never have heard of him. And Socrates, with that action of accepting death, launches an intellectual tradition, launches a philosophical tradition, an ethical tradition, a political tradition that has shaped the Western world. You know, sometimes I think of what he does as an example of the kind of passive resistance that Martin Luther King advocated, that is accepting, violating an unjust law and accepting the punishment for that violation has a transformative effect on society and on the hearts of people. It's the same insight that Gandhi carried. And it's in some ways the same insight that Jesus carried. Jesus accepts the death penalty, asks for forgiveness for his assassins while on the cross. And that act of submission to the punishment of an unjust law transforms the world.
One more question as we wrap up. Not a bad way to go out, I suppose, to give a speech that fails in a sense, but lives on forever, that we still read today. Tell us a little bit more about this transformation, though. Exactly how does he transform the world? I'm going to guess the idea of civil disobedience, passive resistance, and so on. These ideas might have come into our culture in other ways, but maybe not. What is Western civilization, Western culture, the world today, what does it look like without Socrates?
Alfred North Whitehead, the British philosopher, is famous for having said that all of Western philosophy is a footnote to Plato. And if you read, you know, Plato is writing in 5th century Athens. He wrote a lot. Almost everything that he wrote, he puts in the mouth of Socrates. So, you know, as you pointed out at the beginning, he tends to write in dialogue forms, which Socrates is the main speaker with various interlocutors. And Plato is the great systematizer of knowledge. Plato has an understanding and theories about almost every fundamental issue that we in society and as individuals experience, about the nature of ethics, about the nature of law, about the nature of politics, about psychology, about aesthetics, about metaphysics, about epistemology. In each of these areas, plus some, Plato issues a set of challenges, a set of doctrines, a set of convictions, a set of arguments to which people have been responding and which has been shaping the dialogue in Western culture, philosophy, and ethics ever since 5th century Athens. You know, even Christianity, Nietzsche, a famous critic of Christianity, called Christianity Platonism for the masses. And there is a way in which the ethical teachings of Plato, the philosophical understanding of Plato, his critique of the myths and polytheism of Athens, there is a very clear way in which Plato philosophically, ethically prepares the ground for the emergence of Christianity. And of course, some of the great Christian theologians, probably the greatest of all Christian theologians, St. Augustine, is an absolute Platonist. St. Augustine, in fact, discovers Christianity through Plato and ends up saying, you know, this thing that Plato came up with that he calls the supreme good, that's actually God, what he was describing. That's actually the Christian God that he was describing. He came before Christ, but had a kind of rational revelation of the truths of Christianity. So Plato, Socrates, absolutely formative in our conceptual universe, our ethical, political, legal, philosophical understanding of the world is absolutely influenced by Plato, perhaps more than by any other thinker.
Roosevelt Montas, thanks so much for joining us and telling us all about The Apology by Plato.
You're very welcome, John.
You've just listened to the Great Books Podcast, a production of National Review. Please subscribe to the Great Books Podcast and leave reviews of the show. That helps us keep this podcast going. Send me your ideas for future episodes. You can reach me through my website at haymiller.com. On Twitter, my handle is at haymiller. Last of all, special thanks to all of you for listening. We'll be back next week with a new episode of the Great Books Podcast.